well, no one was more surprised that I got to work on NASA missions for a decade and a half than me. I'm always like, dude, you look miserable. I said, yep. My smart mouth, like my dad has told me all my life, is finally going to really get me in trouble. That created so much fear inside of me. I'm so worried about not being a good father.
All right, hey guys, welcome back to the studio. Today we have an incredible guest, John Malura, aerospace engineer, nationally recognized photographer, speaker, and coach. Welcome to the studio, John.
Thanks, brother. So nice to be here, Mike.
Yeah, I'm so happy you're here. Wow, I don't even know where to start with you, but I'm thinking let's start with NASA.
Yeah. Well, no one was more surprised that I got to work on NASA missions for a decade and a half than me, because even though I grew up loving Star Wars, which, by the way, love the background, has very Star Warsy vibes.
Out.
Yeah,
yes.
Shout out to Star Wars. But I didn't do great in school. School was always such a challenge for me. Despite doing well, like, I had to work really hard at it. It just didn't come naturally, which, you know, when I got diagnosed with pretty severe ADD as an adult, I was like, right, that would have been great knowledge to know when I was growing up.
Yeah.
So the way I ended up working for NASA, actually, the genesis of it was I lost my dream internship during college when I was at Penn State with Disney, like the Disney. I was supposed to be one of their Imagineers.
Wow.
And instead of working for Disney and, you know, doing cool things for the big mouse, through a series of events, I found myself, my job that summer was pulling dead mice out of cabins in the Catskills, right?
Not exactly Mickey Mouse.
No. But so about as far away as you could get from working on the next cool thing for Disney. And I was like, man, this is not great. I'm working pretty hard in school to be pulling dead mice out of toilets. So when an opportunity came up to teach rock climbing at the same camp that I ended up working at, I said, I'll do it. And they said, oh, do you know how to rock climb? I said, no, not at all. And they said, okay. I said, but you said you would teach me, right? You're going to send me to a school. And they said, well, yeah. They said, but are you scared of heights? I go, oh, I'm terrified of heights. When do I leave? Because I was like I'm meant for way more than like this right now.
Yeah.
Like,
exactly.
I think when they actually asked me that, I was scrubbing rust off a propane tank out in some field.
Yeah.
You know? So I learned to go teach rock climbing, had a great summer, ran a staff. We worked with scouts from inner city New York. So
wow.
A lot of these kids, like, you know, they never touch grass.
Yeah.
Back in the late 90s. And, you know, here we are rappelling. It's like beautiful over the Delaware River. And I just fell in love with it. Went on to become an instructor at Penn State for their outing club for a number of years for rock climbing. And then fast forward a couple years when I graduated with a degree in mechanical engineering, I put that on my resume because I thought, you know, it showed responsibility. I could lead a staff. I could manage things. I could not kill people.
Yeah.
Doing critical things, right? And I applied for a job for a contractor in the space program. And my buddies and I were all joking one night. We were getting wings and beers on something. They're like, hey, did you see that thing for the company that makes a space suit? Like, we should all apply. Let's be spacemen. Well, they were all joking. I applied.
Hilarious.
Right?
That's awesome.
And I got a call back. And I'm like, oh, but I don't have like a 4.0, not even close. Like, I was like working hard in school. And I was interviewing to be a project manager, which I didn't know what that meant. Knowing what I know now about what a project manager does and my skill set, they are about as far apart as they could possibly be.
Wow.
So, but fortunately, when they saw director of rock climbing on my resume, they're like, that's interesting. I don't think we've ever seen that. They're like, what's that all about? And I gave my little spiel. And they said, hang on, someone just walked by that we want you to talk to. He's the director of test operations here. And I'm like, the heck is that?
Right.
This guy gets on the phone. Remember, this is back in the late 90s. So there's no video. There's no Zoom. There's
right.
Nothing, right? Like, I'm on an old school phone call, you know, cordless phone, you know, with a...
Yes.
You know what I'm talking
yes.
about. We're the same age. And this guy gets on the phone. He doesn't introduce himself at all. And he just goes in this real nasally voice, hey, what do you think about rock climbing on Mars? And me being a proverbial smartass, I go, I don't know, are you gonna pay my airfare?
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my god, I just blew this interview. My smart mouth, like my dad has told me all my life, is finally going to really get me in trouble. And this guy goes, get him down here. And then poof, he was gone. And they're like, okay, well, I guess skip would like to meet with you. So when can we get you down here? And I'm like, is this actually happening? So it turns out this guy, Skip Wilson, who turned out to be one of my first and just most impactful mentors in my life.
Wow.
Was former Special Forces in Vietnam, survival instructor, you know, test pilot stuff in the Air Force until he got out. And I said to him, I'm like, why did you choose me to come down? Because he and I hit it off and that was it. Like, they hired me and that's what I did for 15 years. I tested things across the planet for Mars and, you know, various other things, high-speed military units, Special Forces guys. I got to work with them. But I said to Skip, I said, why'd you pick me? Like, I'm not the smartest guy in the room, like, by any stretch of the means. He said, I don't need another egghead down here. He said, I need someone that's smart enough. He said, but more importantly, I need someone that I can send out into the field. Because we did test operations everywhere from Antarctica to Hawaii to the deserts. He said, I need someone I can send out there in potentially extremely hazardous or fatal situations and know you're going to get the job done. You're not going to get yourself killed and you're not going to get the team killed. He goes, that's you.
Yeah.
So the genesis was I lost the internship at Disney, got tired of pulling dead mice out of toys, said this isn't for me and you know, took action.
Well, it's crazy because these are huge and all this came from you getting out of your comfort zone and just trying new things, like from rock climbing to just applying for the job on a whim.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And now National Geographic, you're an award-winning photographer. I think that's amazing. Yeah. I would love to have a photographer here in the studio. I'm thinking you and your wife may need to relocate.
I don't know. We love the Atlantic coastline where we're at.
Yeah. It's
beautiful. Yeah. Photography had always been a hobby of mine. I think for my 7th birthday, like, I wanted a gerbil. Like, I don't know why. A 7-year-old, like, I want a gerbil. And my mom, in her infinite wisdom, said, John doesn't have the, you know, stick with itness to take care of a gerbil.
Right.
She's like, I'm going to be taking care of this stupid gerbil. You're not getting a gerbil. So she bought me a camera. Like, old school, like, Kodak. Like, this is like 1984.
Oh, I had so it with the strip flash
bulbs. Yes,
I had
exactly
the same
that.
Camera, John. Yes.
Yeah, mine was blue.
The wind.
Was blue. And I just love photography. Like, that you know, that immediacy. Well, back then, you had to wait for them to get developed. But, what, you know.
Yeah.
But I just always loved it. So it was just a hobby I carried with me my whole life. So when I would go on these test operations, and we'd be gone for weeks at a time, I would just throw my camera in my bag and pretend like I was on National Geographic assignment. Because as cool as the engineering job was, I never felt like it was a good fit. Like, the people I worked with were just, like, amazing people. You know, I being in test operations, like, it was always kind of like a bit of a buccaneer crew, which fit very much with my persona. And just the way I approach life. But I never really felt like this was where I was going to be the rest of my life. And through a series of events, after 15 years in engineering, it eventually came aware to me, like, I really was not where I was at, or where I should be. So I'd been doing photography on the side as a side hustle. And I was just so miserable. Like, you know, we were taken over by venture capitalists by this time at our company. It became all about the money. So I did what any self-respecting father of three would do. I went and got another engineering job for even more money. You know, so by this time now I'm like making 6 figures.
Yeah.
They're flying me first class to China to rep the company. Like, seemingly, like, had it all, right? I was miserable. Hated every waking moment of that day, of that job. Again, great people, but, like, it was behind a desk.
Yeah.
I don't sit still real well.
You're just a man of action.
Yeah. Like, sitting behind a desk and arguing, you know, what's better, A32A stainless steel or A32-5 stainless steel. I'm like, I don't know. Just make sure the plane doesn't fall out of the sky. Like, let's go do something. Let's get kinetic.
Yes, exactly.
And it finally got to the point where, like, I was just miserable. And our kids were young at this point. I think our oldest was maybe 9. So, like, we had 9, 7, and 5-year-old. My wife's like, dude, you look miserable. I said, yep. And she said, well, what are we gonna do? She's like, your skin has, like, the pallor of, like, a wet ashtray.
Wow.
Like you don't look good.
Yeah.
And I did a lot of soul searching. And I was like, what I eventually came to was, I realized, do I really want to be getting paid this much money to be this miserable? And that hit, like, a ton of bricks. So I was like, I got young kids at home. Like, what example am I setting for them? That, hey, as long as you're making six figures and you get the first class ticket and all that, it's okay to be miserable and wish every moment you were somewhere else doing anything but this. Yeah. Or do I make the difficult decision and quit hiding behind these like brave delays that I kept giving myself and actually venture out and do something that I felt would satisfy my soul? So my wife and I prayerfully made the decision together in 2017 that I was going to leave engineering and turn my side hustle photography that had been a business building on the side into my full-time gig.
Wow.
So that's why I did, you know, full-time for a number of years was commercial photography after I walked away from engineering.
That's amazing. And that you have the support of your wife to recognize that. That's clearly your soulmate.
Yeah.
Only a soulmate could recognize that.
Right.
Yes. I love the ashtray reference there.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And the National Geographic thing came about was it was a feature on their Daily Dozen thing. They've stopped doing it now. They used to have a whole, they called it Your Shot, National Geographic Your Shot. Because again, we're backing up to like 2015 time frame here.
Yeah.
And people from around the world could upload their photos to like a gallery. It's like a Flickr, you know, kind of thing. But it was National Geographic. So you could upload them, write descriptions. And it was really there for people just to showcase their work, start getting out of their comfort zones. And one of my photos was chosen by National Geographic to focus, to feature. They would pick 12 photos a day out of the, I don't know, 10, 100,000 submitted.
Yeah.
And that came right at the end of my engineering career. So I really took that as a sign that maybe there's really something here.
Yeah.
And the photo is, you know, it was taken with an iPhone 5S, right? And it's a photo of a leaf that is sitting in water and all the fleshy part of the leaf had gone away. But what's left is the structure, the veins.
Wow.
And it's just sitting there and sitting in a field of duckweed, which is, you know, just like real tiny, you know, green moss. So it's a very striking photo. It's really powerful. And when I tell people, like, yeah, National Geographic featured that, or 2016, they're like, wow, the question is always, oh, what gear do you use? I'm like, an iPhone 5S. They're like, oh, and where'd you take it? Was it like a studio? Did you like set it up? I go, that picture was taken on a walkabout I was taking at lunch right when I was contemplating, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? Because I remember this is a couple months before I decided to really leave engineering.
Yeah.
So I'd go on these walks and just like soul search. And that photo was taken in probably the least glamorous place you could think of. So here I am with my iPhone 5S leaning out over the water. It was a drainage pond behind a chicken processing plant.
Wow.
And an industrial park.
Wow. And what a timely representation of yourself within that photo.
Mm.
Like the way you described it, it was like describing yourself.
Yeah. 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 I never even thought of that. Yeah.
Well, we're very similar in the way that we photograph things. I go on a lot of walkabouts and I take a lot of photos in random places. And yeah, I always find a little bit of myself in those photos because it's very representational of the time that I'm in, you know, mentally.
Yeah.
And that's a great representation of where it sounds like you were at that time. It's awesome.
Yeah, so that's National Geographic tie-in, so.
Fantastic. Now, you've won awards for your photography.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we live in Delaware, you know. Shout out, second smallest state in the country. What's up?
Yeah.
Small wonder. But yeah, like best of Delaware for you know, various magazines. I've had my photos chosen to be, you know, featured along like legendary like rock and roll photographers, you know, for photos I took, you know, of actually DJ Jazzy Jeff, his MC at a concert. Jazzy Jeff is a Philly native and he still hangs around that area. He actually I believe still lives in Delaware, and he was doing an opening act for a country artist, Jimmy Allen, years ago. And Jimmy Allen's from like the next town down by us. And I was doing the photography for the event, and it poured. Like, not like a drizzle or a rainstorm, but like sheets of rain. And normally it's like, you know, you got three songs to photograph, you can be in the pit, you're going to be, you know, they're very regimented with concert photography now.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like the old days where, like, you know, there were just photographers just floating around. Like, I was reading that book last night at your place.
Yeah.
With Glenn, where he's talking about it, you just used to be free range. Well, because the weather was so bad, no one was telling me not to go anywhere. They were more worried about keeping the gear dry, you know, doing all the things.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, if security doesn't want me here, then they can tell me. Meanwhile, exactly. They're like holding tarps. I'm like, all right, so I'm going to use this to my advantage. Yeah. So, you know, because that's what all this comes down to is, you know, you gotta just look for the opportunities and take them.
Take the chance. Take action
yeah. on it. Let someone tell you not to.
Yeah.
And the way I found myself even photographing that concert was I used to walk in. We had this little tiny dive bar in one of the real tiny beach towns called the Bottle and Cork. And it's been around for almost 90 years as a music venue.
Wow. So
it's on a strip of land, maybe a half mile wide between the Rehoboth Bay and the Atlantic Ocean. And there's just this rock and roll bar there that they bring in like big names, like country stars, like Justin Moore and stuff will come play there when they're like in like the Philly, DC, New York area. They'll come down there. It's a summer resort town, so they'll play two shows and just have a vacation for the rest couple days. So I used to go in to that bar and take my camera and would just act like I was supposed to be there.
Yeah.
And would just take pictures of everyone for like the Struts, Lanco, you know, when they would come visit, and I would just act like I was supposed to be there. I photographed Kiefer Sutherland when he was there playing, who, by the way, fantastic musician, Kiefer Sutherland.
Yeah.
So eventually the promoter, Vicky, at the bar, who would bring the bands in, she's like, who is this guy that keeps tagging us with all these amazing concert photos? And so she eventually reached out to me and she's like, all right, look, you know you're not supposed to be there, right? I'm like, no one said I couldn't. She's like, all right, smart ass.
Yeah.
She goes, what if we had you be the house photographer and we actually paid you?
That's fantastic.
So that's how I ended up there. So fast forward, I was doing this photo shoot, Jazzy Jeff performance, and his MC jumped up in the air, and I was on side stage, so I was looking out to the crowd, and there's just this like spotlight, and it's coming through just a torrential sheets of rain.
Wow.
And like the guy jumped like 6 feet in the air, has legs all tucked up, and that ended up, you know, in like art museum with, you know, like, you know, legendary rock and roll photographer, and like because he chose the photo. So
yeah.
So like all these accolades have come in, but the wild thing is the accolades never really translated into business. So that's what caused me a couple years ago to be like, all right, I feel like there's like a spiritual pullback on this.
Yeah.
So that's when I really started shifting gears into like being curious about coaching. And someone asked me to tell my story about wrestling with major imposter syndrome during my time leading NASA missions, because I never felt like I should be there. Despite having the accolades and the letters of commendation from the military and NASA, I always felt like I was one mistake away from like people figuring out like I really didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah. Your story just speaks to being divinely guided, it seems like. You're just following your path. You're trusting your gut, your intuition, and following your path. I love – I've never gone rock climbing before, and now you've inspired me to want to give that a go.
Nice. Yeah, go for it.
I started skydiving, actually.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow, you like just went right for it.
And I was afraid of heights, too. Have you ever gone skydiving?
I have not.
So I was experiencing grief through the loss of my brother. My brother had passed away of a drug overdose, and he died on a unique day. It was a Friday the 13th, July, Friday the 13th. And so there's always a superstition around that day or whatever, and I kind of let go of all those superstitions. But that day, a Friday the 13th was coming around, and I had an opportunity to go skydiving. I'd never done it.
Wow.
I was afraid of it. The week leading up, I had so much panic and anxiety.
Yeah.
And then I was just like, it was one of those years where the grief was hitting me. Each year after the loss of him is different.
Yeah.
So I never know how that's going to feel. But that particular week, I was pretty emotional, and I couldn't tell if it was because I was emotional over him or the skydiving.
Right.
So, but I thought it was kind of symbolic in the way of just facing my fear of heights, staring death in the face, and kind of, you know, metaphorically letting go of everything that came with the process of grieving my brother. And so, kind of embracing it versus, you know, living in that constant state of not accepting it.
Yeah. So much energy is used when we don't accept what is.
Yeah.
Like we can't change things like that. And I, you know, I'm very sorry to hear about your brother. You know, my best childhood friend, same thing, overdose in 2009, intentional overdose.
Yeah.
and it is a process. And once you are able to flow with it, it becomes much easier. It's like if you're out in the ocean, like I said, we live on the coastline. Like I was just in the ocean the other night. And like, if you try to stand there and let the wave and like stand up against the waves, if, you know, using that as a metaphor for grief, like you're going to get rolled, you're going to get cut, you're going to get banged, you're going to get, you know, salt water up your nose. But if you're able to let go and just let it flow and get into that flow, like then it can just be, you know, beautiful is probably a bit of a strong word, but you can just get into the flow of it. But man, when you put that resistance up and try to,
see what you're saying, though, using the word beautiful, though, it can be a beautiful experience because, you know, through that beauty is resilience. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a book I read by Shannon Lee, the daughter of Bruce Lee, called Be Water, My Friend. It goes right along with what you're saying. And that book like really touched me when I read it. And I, she shares the teachings of Bruce Lee through that book. And that was another healing modality for me, processing that grief. And that's tough. I know, profound loss. I mean, just getting through that. What are some of the other processes you've gone through in healing that for yourself?
Yeah. So whenever we lost our friend, it came out of the blue, and he and I had been estranged. Like we grew up together. We were very kindred spirits, and you know, actually his wife at the time, her and I had a falling out. And so he and I had been estranged and hadn't talked in a number of years. And when I got a phone call on this like beautiful, just Friday in May from a high school friend, I'm like, Hey, what's up? I hadn't heard from him in years. And she's just sobbing on the other end of the phone. I'm like, what's up? And she just said, he's dead. And I'm like, what's going on? And like, she told me the whole story 3 days prior, you know, found intentional overdose. And when she told me that, it was like in the movies when like a bomb goes off.
Yeah.
And it's like, everything kind of just goes white around the edges. It's like, that's what it was. I just remember like I stood up, like I think I hung up on her.
Yeah.
Like I think I just hung up and I just walked out the door because I was at work and I just walked and walked. I don't even remember the rest of the day.
Yeah.
And at that point in my life, that was a really difficult period for me because almost a year prior, my wife and I just welcomed our first daughter into the world. And that created so much fear inside of me. I was so worried about not being a good father. And not a week or two after our daughter was born, my wife's like, I need to get out of the house. I need to go to like Walmart. Like, I just need some time. I'm like, yeah, totally understandable. Get it.
Yeah.
And she said, all right, daughter's asleep. I'm going to head out. She wakes up. Just give her a bottle. Got it. And, you know, one of my core fears all my life was always not being good enough or not being enough for the people that depended on me or cared about me. So her daughter wakes up. You know, I go pick her up. I'm like, all right, bottle. Go to give her a bottle and she wouldn't take it. In instant panic attack. Because, you know, there's that devil on my shoulder saying, aha, look, this person who requires you for survival, you can't keep them alive. You're not good enough to even feed your own child. And it started this panic attack that just perpetuated. Because I'd always wrestled with anxiety and probably even borderline depression. But, you know, that wasn't something we talked about, you know, in a paramilitary company environment in the early 2000s. Like, you know, suck it up, buttercup kind of mentality.
Absolutely.
You know, here's some whiskey and beer and let's roll. I was just a mess. Our daughter's getting ready to turn one, and then I find out about my friend's suicide. And, like, it just put me in this just awful, awful place where, like, I just couldn't get out of, you know, just thoughts like maybe Nate had it right, you know, checking out. Like, because I can't get out of this. My coping mechanisms aren't helping, which, by spoiler alert, coping mechanisms were not healthy at that point in my life. And I remember just one morning before work, my wife and daughter were out, and I was like, I don't know what to do. And for whatever reason, well, now I realize it's by the grace of God and like the Holy Spirit, the Serenity Prayer just popped in my head. You know, let me know the wisdom to know the difference, you know, is the punchline of that. And as soon as I said that, I felt this warm sensation come over me from head to toe. And the reason why that's important that I prayed was up to that day in 2009, I hadn't prayed for probably 15 years. I graduated from Catholic high school, wanted absolutely nothing to do with any kind of religion, experienced a lot of all the worst that that environment has to offer, and just wanted nothing to do with that or any religion. So much to the point where if I found out someone was religious, it didn't matter if it was Judaism, Christianity, Muslim, I would say to them, what, are you too weak to do life alone? You need the crutch of a God? Like, I would say that to people. Meanwhile, like, I'm falling apart inside, like, for years on end. And so when I prayed, like, that was like my last ditch effort to, like, just do anything. When I felt that warm sensation come over me, I thought, oh, that's new. I've either just lost my mind and cracked up, or maybe there's something to this God thing. And the next thing that happened was, you know, they always say, you know, before God can do some work through you, he's got to do some work in you.
Yeah.
And he had a lot of work to do in me.
Yeah.
And
I get it.
Yeah. So what he did was he started showing me how I was showing up in the world. And, you know, bear in mind, like, I'm about halfway through my career now at this point in engineering. And like I operated with elite teams. Like, I worked with, you know, fighter pilots, special forces operators, you know, leading missions that were landing on Mars. So I was surrounded by elite, and I performed at elite levels. And unfortunately, that included being an elite asshole.
Right.
Right. Like, I was an elite asshole. And by that, I mean, I always had this ability to read people. And to use another Star Wars reference here, I'm going to see how many I can tie in today. Yeah. I would say, like, my ability to read people and to connect with people, I was using it like Darth Vader used the Force. Extremely talented, extremely just intuitive with it, but I used it for evil.
Right.
Because I had such low self-confidence. I had such low belief in myself. Despite, again, like, people look at my resume and be like, how can you not feel worthy or enough? And I'm like, it goes beyond letters of commendation. It was a soul level unworthiness. So to protect myself, my goal was to build up this like kind of superhero veneer. And if I felt that was being challenged at all, like someone could ask me a question in a meeting at work, and like I would just like unload on them and cut them off at the knees. And because I could read people, like, they'd be very cutting remarks. Like, I would know what buttons to push on people.
Yeah.
So after my friend's death, when God started showing me how I was showing up in the world and the proverbial scales started falling from my eyes, I was like, wow, I got a lot of work to do on myself. So yeah. I started noticing, like, I was a test engineer, so data was what I did. So I started noticing, like, when I would lose my temper, when I'd lose my cool, and kind of play it back and figure out, like, what was triggering me. And then started doing the hard work of apologizing to people. Like, reaching out to people from, like, high school or, like, middle school even. And they're like, and the wild thing is, if you've ever gone through a journey like that, the things you think people are going to be like, I'm so glad you apologized about that. Those were the ones where they're like, what are you talking about? You know, like, I built this all up in my head. Like, this is the thing. Like, and then other people, like, I would just kind of be like, oh, hey, yeah, sorry about when I did that. And they're like, you have no idea how much I've carried that with me for decades.
Wow.
So that was a lot of the work that got done in myself to, you know, turn this around 180, yeah, to start building that empathy, and then also using that ability to read to people to connect with them for good and to help them feel seen.
That's amazing. And I can relate so much to your story and the power of prayer, because I had gone down another path, just substance use and various things after the loss of my brother. Just everything increased after that. And I also, after that time, disconnected from faith. I grew up in the church. We were raised in the church, and I went in every other direction against it,
yeah,
much like you described. And then after the passing of my brother, even more so, I was just disconnected. But I've always worked with families throughout the years, and I was always very accepting of other people's faith and very respectful of other people's faith and religions and all those things. But I kept to myself regarding my beliefs and my thoughts on everything. And I carried that inside me. And then I had a series of unfortunate events happen. The trajectory of my life had changed and I was on a new path. And I would go on these walkabouts and I would have my phone with me and I would take pictures. And I was sitting there one day and I was praying. And so I understand, I know the feeling that you have. I yeah. had turned to prayer, and it was one of those things where I was literally down on my knees in the woods
yeah.
and I was praying. And then this white deer appears, like wow. this white deer started.
I got goosies, man.
Yeah. Well, I've had them the whole time you've been talking, because yeah. we've led a similar path. And, this white deer, like I'd never seen a white deer before, and I wasn't even sure what the hell was happening. So, because it sounds so weird, right?
Oh,
and so,
I hear you.
Because yeah. I was in such despair, and I was mm-hmm. like, what is going on? And then, like, it was just, I was processing that because I was in the middle of like a self audit, like you were. You know, I was auditing all of these things that I had done over the years and people that I'd interacted with. And I was accepting that there were people that were the villain in my story, but I was also the villain in other people's stories.
Yeah.
And so I had found my way shortly after that encounter with the deer, found my way to, after losing my temper in traffic, pulled into a parking lot, and it was this beautiful church. Mm-hmm. And it looked like Batman's castle. It was enormous. Wow. And so I went in, and it was empty, and I sat in the very back pew, and I grabbed a pencil and paper that they had available, and I had started writing like whose story I was the villain in and vice wow. versa. I was the villain in other people's stories, and they mirrored each other on both sides. And I was like, interesting, because everybody's carrying something about an experience, and everyone sure. perceives your interactions with them differently. And so I was just evaluating that, and then I began asking for forgiveness wow. to those people. Same thing. So it was very powerful, and I was very blessed to be going through that. And it's deep, dark work. So yeah. I can appreciate where you are at with that. And that, so my eyes have been welling up the whole time you were talking. So it was much like that during the whole process. You know, I constantly had tears in my eyes because yeah. I was going through that process, but it was kind of like this awakening point. It felt yeah, like
absolutely.
I could feel that happening, and I was at the lowest of my low point. And it's a blessing. It's such a blessing to experience that and come out on the other side.
Yeah.
And it sounds like, you know, you've really parlayed that into a beautiful career, being able to speak on stages and share your story yeah. and your coaching. And I think that with the coaching platforms right now, it's so heavily saturated.
Yeah.
But I mean, you've got something really special with your story and what you're doing. And talk a little bit about how you found your way into speaking and coaching. You were always good at, or was that another fear you were facing, like rock climbing? Never done it before, but
yeah,
this is my story and I'm going to share it.
Yeah, again, it wasn't even on my radar. And I kind of, I always joke, I'm like, I like Forrest Gump my way through life. Like, I just kind of like, just find my way into things. And looking back, I always loved being on stage. Like, I think I was in my first play when I was like, in, I think, first grade. Like, I don't know, like hearing my mom tell the story, she's like, yeah, it was a really weird kind of script. It sounds like a fever dream. It was like the Wizard of Oz, but I was Santa Claus in it, and it put on a parochial elementary school. Like I'm really not sure, but I just remember thinking that was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And then was, you know, we moved a couple times, and you know, whenever we moved and I was in middle school, like that was like kind of the beginning of like where I really started putting my guards up, you know, through various, you know, trials, tragedies, and of course we were going through a transition with moving. So I really fell away from that, but always like playing in like bands in high school, you know, like, you know, the punk bands and stuff like that, you know, trying to be like the next Misfits kind
yeah,
of thing.
Garage
yeah.
bands.
Yeah. Oh yeah. yeah. And then was in a play senior year, but I never did anything with that. And then when I was in engineering, an opportunity came up to join Toastmasters.
I've heard of Toastmasters. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a worldwide organization that helps people, that gives people the skills and, you know, a supportive environment to become better speakers, to become better communicators, because how couldn't the world be better with more, you know, powerful communicators, right?
Yeah.
So our vice president at the engineering company had a lot of anxiety speaking in front of people, and he recognized that. And he's like, I need to step up. Like, I'm the vice president. So he took it upon himself to go to Toastmasters and then said, this was so powerful for me, I'm willing to create a corporate chapter here. The company will cover all the costs. You'll learn how to speak. So I raised my hand, said, that sounds cool. I'll do it. And man, how powerful was that in my career?
Yeah.
Especially in engineering, which I don't know if you're aware of this, but engineers are not known for their sparkling personality and, you know, communication abilities.
I am aware of that.
Yeah. Not a real good, well-kept secret. The joke was always like, how do you tell an outgoing engineer? It's like, I don't know. It's like, well, they look at the other person's shoes when they talk instead of their own.
Right. I love it.
So then people would seek me out to do the presentations for the company because I was trained now.
Yeah.
And had the reps and just always enjoyed it. But I always thought that was for other people to do. You know, other people were speakers or other people got on stages. Like, who would do that kind of stuff? And then as fate would have it, I was helping some buddies film something one day a couple years ago, and they were in a band. They're like, hey, we need an extra. I'm like, all right, whatever. Sure. Put a wig on me and a fake handlebar mustache. I'll be Richie Camaro, the drug lord in the music video. Whatever. No one's going to know it's me. And as we were talking between takes, they were talking about, it's so hard, I can't keep a guitar player. And I jokingly said, I play guitar. And they're like, they're like, really? I said, yeah. They go, are you any good? I go, I can like bang out some Buffett songs and acoustic versions of Guns N' Roses. They're like, good enough. You seem like you're fun in front of a camera. They're like, we're going to be all about stage presence and experience, just straight rock and roll. I'm like, well, I can do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So for a number of years, you know, created this band, you know, developed a pretty good following, you know, have an EP like out on Spotify, shout out Great Big Liars is our name. And that, like, when I was on stage, like, something in me just came alive.
Yeah.
And this is like 2023. Like, I'm an adult. I'm like in my mid 40s at this point. And I'm like, now I'm starting to play in like bands, but something came alive. And right at that time, again, just this divine, just intervention, and just also being willing to open to experiences. Someone in a coaching group that I'm part of called Brand Builders out in Nashville, someone said, hey, we're looking for people to share stories about imposter syndrome to our private community. And I'm like, I'll do it. Like, I was like, that sounds cool. I wrestled with that a lot because I got a letter of commendation once from the Department of Defense for a project I was a leader on for a number of years. And I can remember before I got the letter, I was standing there in front of the whole company and our company presidents issuing the letters out and saying your name and everyone's cheering and shake your hand, that kind of thing. And I can remember before my name got called, I had a panic attack.
Wow.
In front of the whole company. And here I was, this like badass test engineer that built this reputation up for being dangled off the end of a crane over the Gulf of Mexico to go fix something. That was the kind of stuff I did because, you know, if it was potentially hazardous, like I was raising my hand because then I thought, well, maybe then I'll feel worthy. Well, spoiler alert, I didn't. Right. But like, I was getting ready to receive this letter of commendation, like big deal, like from the military. And I thought, oh my God, when they call my name, the president's probably going to be like, you know what? We've realized that you've been BSing everybody for all these years. You don't get yours. I had this whole, this vision just popped in my head. He called my name. I shook his hand and went off the stage and never believed I should have that despite years of
hard work.
And like the thing was doing what it's still doing, what it's supposed to be doing out where it's supposed to be doing it to keep bad people from doing things. We'll just leave it at that. And that letter of commendation sat at my desk for a decade. Just, you know, all the months away from home, years, you know, traveling, putting myself in hazardous situations. I didn't want anyone to know. I didn't want to see light of day. So when they asked me to tell the story on imposter syndrome, I'm like, oh, that's what I had.
Yeah. Isn't that therapeutic and cathartic?
Putting a name to it. How powerful. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I was like, all right, I'll tell the story. So they're like, okay, we'll record it in like 3 months. So for the next 3 months, I worried if I was qualified enough to tell a story about imposter syndrome.
I love it.
So like, again, it came from me just raising my hand and being like, that sounds cool.
Yes.
Let me try it. And
yeah.
Then they're like, after it, they're like, that's one of the best things we've ever had for our community. They're like, is it okay if we turn it into a paid course? Because people are clamoring for it.
That's
and we
awesome.
We don't offer that unless it's a paid course. I'm like, what's that mean? And they're like, well, basically people will pay for it. We'll take a cut and you get the rest. I'm like,
You're getting paid to be you.
I'm like, yeah. Like, what a concept. Like, I spent so many decades hating myself.
Yeah, exactly.
And now it's like, wait, what I've gone through and what I'm doing can actually help somebody. And that's how the whole speaking thing started years ago.
And it all came from accepting yourself, your gifts and your talents.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
And you're staying over at the studio house. Did you notice the mug that I have in the Keurig?
I drank a cup of coffee out of it this morning. I didn't even ask my wife if she wanted it. I said, that one's mine.
I'm going to gift you one of those mugs
because I have two.
I just got those.
Oh, dude, I love it.
Yes.
I saw that. I'm like, my tribe.
Yes.
Mike gets me.
Yes, totally. Just talking to you, it feels like I went to high school with you for sure. I feel like I grew up with you because you remind me of a lot of my friends growing up, and we've definitely walked similar paths. And even the Toastmasters thing, it's funny because I was seeking out Toastmasters. That's how I know about Toastmasters. I was seeking that out, and there was a chapter of that here in one of the neighboring communities, and I think it went away. I don't think it was available. So I never did end up connecting with those folks. But sounds like you've got a great coaching platform as well. So are you guys, how does that work? Are you guys mobile? You guys travel, your coaching platform and the things that you're connected with?
Yeah. So my coach, you know, is from Brand Builder. Shout out Kristen. She's fantastic. She's been working with me for years. Brand Builder's whole premise is they help mission-driven messengers reach the people that need to hear the message. It was started by a husband and wife team, Rory and AJ Vaden. Rory is actually a Toastmaster Championship speaker.
Wow.
Yeah, so fantastic couple, and they realized that there's so many people like yourself and me, Mike, that want to do good out in the world, but they don't know how to position themselves. So it's all about they help people create mission-driven brands. And their big thing is you're best suited to serve the you that you used to be. You're best suited to serve the you that you used to be. And they say, look, people aren't going to pay for information, but they're going to pay for application. So they're all about like coming up with the frameworks and the systems, because you can only ever rise to the level of your systems. Like, no, it's not sexy. No one wants to talk about it.
Yeah.
So that's what's helped me develop like all the systems I have in place. And, you know, all the 6 checkpoints I have for my coaching curriculum. And it's just very powerful to be able to have that framework. So my coaching is very much modeled after that. Like, I don't just sit there and talk for, you know, a course is getting released that I put together. You know, it's like probably 10, 12 hour course. It's not just me talking at the camera saying like, here's what I did. I'm awesome.
Yeah.
You know, you can do it too.
Right.
What it is I provide people the frameworks of the mindsets that have got me to where I'm at, and then embedded throughout are application exercises that only take like 3 to 5 minutes each. But if people want the impact and they want the change in their life, because it's one thing to listen, right? To get this knowledge, like you listen to a podcast, you read a book and it's like, oh, that was good. But then a lot of times you're left wondering like, what the heck do I do with my
implementation?
Life? Yeah,
I'm big on implementation.
Yeah, it's huge. So that's what my coaching. It's called Elite Level Action. That's what it's all about. So here's information for you to think on. Now let's put it in terms of your life and like apply it into your life.
And customization. It sounds like, you know, everything's kind of tailor made to each individual. I know like that's kind of how I need things when I'm working with any kind of coach and anything that I do. It seems like when you have chemistry with the coach and you guys vibe together, you tailor make the, you know what I mean? The best suited plan for you to implement into your life.
Absolutely. And I mean the formula that some of my mentors have poured into me, they're like, when you're doing coaching, like, you should really only be talking like 20-30% of the time.
Right.
Like, let the person talk and then give them space, because at the end of the day, that's one of my main functions as a coach with one-on-one people, is providing a space for them to be curious and helping them shift out of autopilot and becoming aware.
Yeah. I love that. Giving people space and also meeting people where they're at.
Oh, absolutely.
That's huge. Yeah. Just kind of meeting people where they're at. I know there was a lot of coaches. Like I remember trying to get out of my comfort zone. I found my way to kickboxing for a very short period of time. And usually anytime I try something, I'll do it for 90 days just to make sure. Yeah. Like I give it 3 months.
Sure.
If I'm gonna hang it up, then there must be a reason. If I go forward, there must be a reason. Mm-hmm. And that one, I hung it up because of the coach. Mm-hmm. He wasn't good. He couldn't meet me where I was because I had some mobility issues, and he kept overestimating what I could do, and we weren't in alignment. So I moved forward. But there's nothing better than a coach that can meet you where you're at, so you can grow together.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's fantastic. You got a great platform going.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
How many books are you going to write?
Just starting on one.
Are you at in that process?
Thinking about it.
Okay,
I wanted to get the course.
Well, you know what's going to happen because everything that every bit of this conversation that we've had since you've gotten here has led up to, I think, that point.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's the next obvious step for you, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And then you'll be up on stage promoting the book.
That's right. Yes, that's right.
I love it.
Yeah. And being on stage is a lot of fun, and meeting people where they're at and creating that space is something I've just found myself in working with some niche communities. I've worked with, you know, realtors, but where I found myself really serving probably over the past year is the first responder community. Because my father was a state trooper, you know, growing up, and I'm able to connect with them because a lot of times they're like, oh, here comes just, you know, some more fluff. I got to sit through training.
Yeah.
But given my background, I'm able to be like, hey, like they know I'm not just, you know, some talking head coming in. It's like, hey, I lived this. I was in the desert in the night, like trying to figure this out, you know, while I was working. And this is how I did it, and providing that space. And I was blown away. I did a 4-hour workshop for the state of Virginia's first responder community a couple months ago. And I was like, you know, I had it all outlined, and my coach Kristen helped me, you know, develop like how to actually structure it. And we use like the think, pair, share methodology, which is where, you know, when they do the application exercise, because no one wants to hear anyone talk for 4 hours straight.
Right. That's a long time.
That's a long time. So I had those exercises embedded throughout the workshop. And the think, pair, share was beautiful because the think part is they just work on their own. They have their, you know, they have the printout, and they answer their question like, how are they sabotaging themselves in relationships based on what I just shared with them? Some things to look out for. Here's the framework, how to check it. How do you check in against that? So that'd be the think part. And then the share part, they're sitting at tables. I said, look, for a couple minutes, if you wanted to just start talking to the people next to you, go for it. Because like this is like in front of like 200 of people.
Yeah.
Like I wasn't going to ask someone just to raise their hand cold. And so, and then the pair part was couples. And then the share part is, okay, if you heard anything at your table that you think would benefit the rest of the group, or if you have something that you want to share personally that came up for you, you know, feel free. If not, I'm not calling on anybody.
Like, yeah.
That's not what we're doing here. I actually had to modify my timeline in real time because they were sharing so much.
Wow.
Like these stoic, like prison guards, state troopers, like paramedics, like people that are never called when things are going well.
Exactly. Right? I live that life. So.
Okay. Yeah. So that was really, really powerful. And the best compliment I ever got for any of my speaking was there was a gentleman there who had been doing that for a very long time. I think he was retired at this point. And he said, I don't know if any of you have ever gone to counseling sessions, and everyone kind of grumbled. He goes, and he looked at me, he goes, young sir, I don't know how you did this, but you just pulled off the biggest group therapy session I have ever seen. Cause there are like people crying and stuff. And
yeah.
Meanwhile, I'm like praying, like my heart's going, I'm like, I am way in over my head. I'm like, God, you gotta give me some words. But being able to create that space for people in that community has been really powerful because.
Well, that's huge because I am a first responder. Wow. And I have a nonprofit organization. It's 24-hour in-home care. And when I've been, I founded my organization in 2016. It's a lot, you know, and I never get the good news calls. So I've seen a lot of people pass away. You know, it's a lot to take in. And I work with first responders. And so with an organization like mine, I'm connected to all the first responders also. And so it can be dark at times for that community. And I don't think people really realize what people are carrying with them. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of PTSD, a lot of trauma in there. And with good folks like you kind of getting in that arena to help bring people out of the stigma of sharing, that's a game changer. That's big.
Right. Or even put pen to paper for their own stuff. And like no one else needs to see it right now.
Right.
But there's so much power in writing things down.
I believe that. So, I mean, people can call it what they want, journaling, whatever, if you're uncomfortable with the term journaling,
because
people think it's like Dear Diary. It's not really like that. It's just pen to paper, honestly.
Yeah.
It's just writing out your thoughts or speaking your thoughts. Mm-hmm. Like, I was just having a conversation with someone the other day, a friend of mine, Greg, and he was talking about how he'll talk to himself. And I'm like, oh, I do it too. I'm like, I walk around the house, I got the dogs, just purging thoughts, right? And then if I say something clever, I make sure to write it down.
Yeah. I have a Google Drive called Good Ideas.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, I got to do that.
Yeah.
But it's therapeutic and it's so good. And I think a lot of people just need a starting point. If you can get anybody in a room, like you mentioned that, the impact that you had on that group and your and that gentleman recognized that and praised you for it. I mean, just getting there, just getting into a room to hear someone like yourself that can bring that out of people, that's a great starting point right there. Yeah. That was a big thing for me and a big game changer was getting out of my comfort zone and going to events where I felt like I didn't belong.
Yeah.
Years ago, I started doing that. Wow. I was like, I jumped on a plane. I went in these rooms and it was like just network. I wouldn't network with anyone. I would just be there.
Yeah.
And then I started networking and you just move past that and you realize like, we're all the same. Everyone's going through the same thing. And and just connecting with people is really going to take you to the next level. And you'll see, nobody really knows what they're doing. Everyone's just getting through it together. We're all walking together.
Absolutely. And whenever I'm talking to people that hear my story, they're like, oh, I can't believe you've started over so many times. And I always say, well, I can understand why you would say that, but let's reframe that because you're never starting over. They're like the only time you're starting from scratch is like the moment you're born.
Right.
After that, it's just reapplying the knowledge you have into the current situation.
And it's like the next chapter I saw it as. People would say similar things to me and I never looked at it that way. It was just kind of like, the next experience. It was an evolution of growth, personal, professional development. And it's continuing to get that way. It's like, I think I enjoy getting older because the knowledge that comes with it and the experience and just the people that you get to meet. If you're focused on those things, your personal and professional development, like just getting to have a conversation with you, that's fantastic. Like you can't beat, that's priceless,
right.
You know? I think it's great.
Yeah, I could deal with less aches and pains, though.
Yeah.
Can we just
that's for that? Sure. Yes.
Yeah. Why do things hurt? Why does jumping off of things hurt so much now?
Exactly. We have to engage in less risky behavior. But now that I'm closer to 50 and now getting into rock climbing, because you inspired me, now I've got to do it. Do you do the rock climbing walls? Like, is there anywhere where you are where you do the rock climbing walls, or is it mountains only, like Kilimanjaro?
Yeah, nothing like that. I mean, I haven't climbed in years since I moved to Delaware. I grew up in Pennsylvania, so there it was rife with things. But Delaware's flat. And where we live, haven't been rock climbing gyms till recently.
Okay.
But when I taught, it was on like natural rocks, like come off in your hand and you yell rock,
wow.
You know, when things were coming off.
That's exhilarating.
Yeah. Yeah. And good news is maybe I should get back into it. It's low impact.
Like, yeah, for sure. Wow. It's been such a pleasure having you on the podcast today. I want to share your links with everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. So I kept it simple. It's johnmallura.com, johnmallura.com. And if you go to /free stuff, I got free resources there.
Amazing.
Yeah. You can download my flight plan for Elite Action. It's got my 6 checkpoints, you know, to follow your path. You know, we talk about, you know, confidence because confidence is so big and so lacking. And the reason why we lack confidence a lot of times is because we break promises with ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like we say, well, I don't understand why I lack so much confidence. And I will say, well, how are you keeping promises to yourself? Like, well, not real great. And I'm like, well, your brain's learning not to trust you. So keep those little promises to yourself. You know, whether it's flossing your teeth every night, like you told your dentist you were going to.
Yes.
Start doing those little things, because when you start keeping promises and operating with integrity with the little things, well, then when the big things come up, your brain's like, okay, I said we're going to do this, we're going to do it. So it's learning about your confidence, how to take action, how to keep momentum going. You know, that's my third checkpoint. The fourth is focus, which is like, how do we stay focused and not get distracted by everything going on around us?
Very hard these days.
Oh,
everything moves so fast.
Yeah, there's everything moves so fast. I mean, there's a bajillion-dollar industry of social media trying to compare you to, you know, someone in New Zealand that's running an all-organic goat farm. You're like, ah, I should be feeding my kids like that. So it's like, how do you maintain focus? I give, again, giving people frameworks, giving them the application for how to do that. And then one of the fifth one is putting structure in place for relationships. Like, how do we maintain these boundaries? How do we draw these lines in the sand that protect our time, not out of selfishness, but so we can serve people from a place of fullness? Yeah. And then finally, I help people like understand, like, what legacy do you want to build? And I have them create, you know, give them again the framework to figure out like what they want their financial life to look like, their health to look like, their relationships, their growth. Because once you figure out who the future you is in your life, you can leverage that when it comes time to make decisions in the moment. Because as we wrap up, what I want to leave people with is, if you're asking yourself when a decision comes up, do I want to do this or don't I? You're asking a way wrong question. Because what happens if you say, I don't want to do that? I don't want to wake up and go running today. I don't want to eat healthy. I don't want to have that critical conversation that's going to really move this relationship forward.
Yeah.
So don't stop asking, do I want to do this or don't I? Spend the time to define who this future you is, because then when the decision comes up, now you can ask a better question. Now you can ask the question of, is this decision going to keep me stuck where I'm at? Or is this decision going to cause me to be a hero to this future version of myself?
Yeah.
Then it becomes very binary. It's a yes or no question. Do I want to stay stuck? Yeah. Well, that doesn't feel good to say, does it?
Some people do.
Right.
You have to get past that. It's all about personal accountability. That's what I love about your framework, is that it all comes back to accountability.
Right.
Essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. We are the only people we can control.
Yeah.
Like, I can't control you.
Accepting that as a game changer. That was huge for me during that spiritual awakening, however you want to word that, term that. But for me, it was a turning point for me.
Absolutely.
And it was all about accountability. Mm-hmm. You really only have yourself at the end of the day. You can't blame anything on anybody, because you're responsible for your decisions.
100%.
Yeah.
100%.
It's amazing. So if someone wants to seek you out for your coaching platform, they would just go to johnmalora.com.
Yeah, johnmalora.com. You can book a complimentary 30-minute call with me, see where you're at, see if there's an alignment, if I can help you get where you want to go. And then coming this fall of 2025, will be johnmalora.com courses. There'll be a self-paced course, and then, you know, of course, opportunity one-on-one coaching in addition to that. So johnmalora.com for all your John Malora needs.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, I'm looking forward to the book.
All right, brother.
Got to get cracking on that.
Yeah, I'm right on that.
All right. Follow John Malora at johnmalora.com and social media handle, Instagram. You're on Instagram too, right?
Yeah, John_Malora. That's the beauty of having a unique name, M-O-L-L-U-R-A.
Yes, sir. All right,
Not a lot of us out there.
The amazing John Malora, and that's a wrap.